Number 9477, State of Ohio versus Thomas Dunlap. Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, John Martin, on behalf of Thomas Dunlap, who comes before the Court today seeking reversal of his convictions for gross sexual imposition, although not seeking reversal in this appeal for the dissemination charge for which he was also convicted. Your Honors, this case calls upon this Court. Your Honor, I'm sorry, Mr. Chief Justice, may I have 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Save 5 minutes, yes.
Thank you. That's always a risk.
It is always a risk.
This case calls the Court to deal with the issue of the mens rea, but more than just the mens rea, the entire mental state, and that distinction comes up in this case because of issues of secondary intent, but to look at the mental state of gross sexual imposition in the context of victims under the age of 13. And in this case, three positions have been posited for this Court's review. The Eighth District maintains that gross sexual imposition is a strict liability offense. Mr. Dunlap maintains that there are two separate mental states in this case. Recklessly with respect to the touching of the person's erogenous zone, and then a secondary intent, much like we see in a burglary statute, for the purpose of sexual gratification, a separate purpose of sexual gratification that comes, and Mr. Dunlap draws that from the definition in 2907.01b of sexual contact. Sexual contact is any touching of an erogenous zone, which has been defined in a list to include a number of different portions of the body. And then in that final prepositional phrase, for purpose of sexual gratification or arousal. Our position that recklessly is the mens rea that defines the sexual contact is consistent with Revised Code 2901.22, which sets forth that the default mens rea, when none is mentioned in a statute or in a statutory provision, is that of recklessness unless the General Assembly has clearly evinced strict liability. And in this case, we've gone through in our brief why it is that strict liability is an absolute incorrect analysis of this. And the reason why it's incorrect is because the General Assembly was very specific in saying strict liability as to the age of the victim, and expressio unius est exclusio alterius, if my Latin is fairly close, tells us that when they expressly state something about one portion of a statute and don't about another, that the General Assembly knows what it's saying, and it's saying strict liability as to this portion only.
Can you give me a practical example of a reckless act with the purpose for sexual gratification? Can you give me how that I'm having trouble putting my hands around or my head around how this really plays out in a practical application to these type of cases.
And to give you that, yes, I can, Your Honor, and to give you that practical application, and it's important to remember that this Court is having to look at gross sexual imposition in terms of all of its applications, not just the application that comes before the Court in my case. But GSI is also a juvenile offense. 13-year-old little Johnny, who is in puppy love with his girlfriend, who is 12, for purposes of sexual gratification, wants to hold her hand. If, in the course of his clumsiness, he grazes upon, now he's done that for purpose of sexual gratification. If, in the course of his clumsiness, he grazes upon one of the designated erogenous zones, if instead of placing his hand on her knee, which is not a designated erogenous zone, it slips and it's on her thigh, which is, according to the 8th District, strict liability applies, and he's adjudicated a delinquent. That type of... There are lots of things that we do for gross... lots of things that we do for sexual gratification, if you will, that don't rise to the level of GSI. A peck on the cheek. But if in the course of doing that, according to the 8th District, you graze upon some other designated erogenous zone, the breast, for example, the thigh, the buttocks, then, according to the 8th District, when the victim is under 13, you have a GSI having been committed. Now, I realize my client is not a 13-year-old. I understand that. He's a 26-year-old. He should not have been doing what the jury found he did. Make no mistake about that.
Mr. Martin, the only reason that we're here is because of the Cologne case. Is that correct? I mean, normally, before Cologne, if this case were indicted as a gross sexual imposition case, and if this case were indicted with the language of the statute, that your client would have been on notice that the purpose for sexual gratification is there, which is the higher standard, and would be on notice of what the state had to prove. And if there had been a defect in the indictment under Rule 7A, it could have been amended, correct?
A defect in the indictment under the O'Brien case of this
right.
court could have been amended, Your Honor. But I would not say that the only reason we're here is because of Cologne. Because this court has dealt in other cases besides Cologne with these kinds of issues of split mental states. Most recently in Clay, the weapon under disability charge, the defendant being under indictment, knowingly possessed a firearm. And this court said knowingly goes to the possession of the firearm, not to scienter with respect to being under indictment. With respect to the scienter of being under indictment, this court applied recklessly. Same thing that we're asking the court to do here today. This is not cited in my brief, but in response to Your Honor's question, the court dealt in 2008 with Wamsley, which was a case of a burglary case where there had not been an instruction on reckless with respect to the trespass. And, of course, in an aggravated burglary, you have a reckless with respect to the trespass. You still have purpose to commit a criminal offense in another portion. And this court found error and then sent it back to the Court of Appeals for a plain error analysis. So I would not say that Cologne does not break new ground, or put it this way, Cologne does not come from whole cloth, and nor does this court's jurisprudence since Cologne abandon Cologne. So it's more than just Cologne. Cologne is, of course, an example. Cologne shows us that the error in this case is structural, but other cases of this court have shown that nonetheless error has occurred. And the
Cologne 2 clarify Cologne 1 in your view, or what is the understanding of Cologne 2 in your world?
Cologne 2 recognizes that oftentimes defects in the indictment, even when accompanied by defects in jury instructions, can be satisfied. Well, Cologne 2 recognizes that these types of mens rea defects can oftentimes be the subject of plain error. But Cologne 2 states that when the absence of the operative mens rea permeates the entire proceedings, so that in Cologne 2, or in the Cologne line of cases, Cologne 1 and 2, you had a bad indictment. It carries through. It includes bad jury instructions as well that fail to talk about the missing mental element. There's never been an amendment to the indictment. And so the Cologne 1 and 2 still stand for the notion that when mens rea is missing throughout the entirety of the proceeding, that a structural error occurs.
Even though when you talk about the missing mens rea, it defaults to recklessly, as you mentioned at the beginning.
Yes, Your Honor. Even though in Cologne it was a reckless mens rea that was missing. That was the default mens rea that was missing in Cologne. Your Honors, and in this case, the structural nature of the error becomes very apparent.
If we agree with you,
yes,
and accept reckless as the default standard as to that portion of the indictment, what happens to this case?
It goes back for a new indictment and a new trial. And, in fact, my client's at risk because of the fact that he's just about completed, if he hasn't already completed, his two-year sentence. And, therefore, we run the risk that when we go back to trial, that we may, subject, of course, to North Carolina versus Pierce presumptions, we may run the risk that if trial goes worse for us the next time, if the trial court finds new information out that it finds aggravating, my client could even get more time.
That kind of makes me... That thought occurred to me because I wonder why he would appeal under these facts, because their facts aren't exactly favoring his position under any standard.
We welcome the opportunity to put this case to the test of trial a second time. Mr. Dunlap has always maintained that he did not engage in any of this touching and continues to maintain that today. Now, interestingly, and the structural nature of the permeating nature of the error in this case manifests itself in the fact that the grand jury in this case, coming out of the 8th District, where 8th District case law had already been well established that this is a strict liability offense, we have a grand jury that would have been treating that touching as strict liability. A Pettit jury that's instructed as to purpose of sexual gratification, but not instructed as to any mens rea attendant to the touching. The prosecutor in this case at page 302 of the transcript, and this is not a case where the prosecutor's comments were as aggravated, if you will, as they were in Cologne. And I might add that in this situation, the court will recall that in Cologne, it made note as well of the prosecutor's comments and how that emphasized the notion of the missing mens rea, because the prosecutor said, all I have to prove is X, Y, Z. And to a certain extent, I feel sorry for prosecutors in this situation, because all they're doing is correctly repeating the law that's the subject of the instructions. The prosecutor in this case, at 302, doesn't say anything about a mens rea with respect to the contact with the erogenous zone, but does then talk about the recklessly mens rea with respect to the dissemination count. And so, if you will, by juxtaposition, is telling the jury, and yeah, you worry about recklessly with respect to this. Ironically, in this case, the state takes the position that the mens rea is purposely with respect to the touching. And the state does so, I would submit, because by saying that purposely applies to the touching, they are hoping that the purpose of sexual gratification in a separate prepositional phrase in the definition of sexual contact can somehow bootstrap itself to the front of the definitional section.
But the whole thing about an indictment, the notice to the defendant, to what the state has to prove, purpose is the highest standard that must be met. So in a sense, what you, I can totally understand your argument if you would be saying the missing element is purpose. But you're saying the missing element is recklessness, and that's the default standard that you've admitted. Defendants know, at the very least, if there's a missing element, it is reckless by default. That's what's to be proved. And if the state has something higher to prove, it's going to be noticed in the indictment. Knowingly, purposely has to be there. And it always is, because that's how the statutes are defined.
Your Honor, whether it's recklessly or purposely, Mr. Chief Justice, may I have leave?
Yes.
Thank you. Whether it's recklessly or purposely, the mens rea is missing from the any contact or any touching portion of the definition. And you cannot bootstrap purpose of sexual gratification from the back end of that definition to the front without violating Clay. Now, Your
Counsel,
Honor.
Counsel, does it matter that your client, from what I understand you said earlier, says he never touched her at all?
It does not matter.
Because if there is a finding that he touched her, and the jury then finds for the purpose of sexual gratification, isn't it inherent in the finding of the purpose for sexual gratification that it was in a erogenous zone,
no,
which is the subject of whether he touched her or not?
In this particular case, the evidence from the complaining victims was that the touching took place in an erogenous zone. But when the court looks at the structure of the statute, and when the court looks at the whether or not the grand jury, because the grand, and if I may go back, the grand jury indictment is more than simply a question of notice. It is also an affirmation by the grand jury that they have considered each and every element of the offense. Now, and the problem here is they did not consider a mental element with respect to that first touching. With that in mind, when this court looks at a structural problem, this court abandons any view of looking at it from the point of view of any particular facts. In Cologne, for example, the factual background of that case was not what was at issue, because what you had in Cologne was an indictment that did not charge an offense because it was missing an element. It had never been amended, and a petit jury that never considered the element as well. And that's what you have here. And so, therefore, the facts of this case are not what is issue and are not what is integral to this court's analysis. Moreover, the fact that my client was denied that grand jury right to have the grand jury consider each and every one of those elements by a grand jury that not only didn't consider it, but in light of 8th District case law, a Cuyahoga County grand jury would have been treating this as a strict liability offense. That constitutes not just a structural error, but also even under a plain error analysis, requires reversal. Mr. Chief Justice, you've been very kind in allowing me to go over. If the court has no further questions, I thank the court and reiterate my prayer.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Regas.
Good morning. Alan Regas for the State of Ohio. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney in Cuyahoga County. For once, I think I have to agree with Mr. Martin as to one statement. I think the 8th District was wrong in finding this to be a strict liability offense. Everything else he said, I disagree with. The statute plainly contains the mens rea of purpose. Logically, if the jury finds that the act was done for the purpose of sexual gratification, they found the criminal intent of purpose. It can't be done. The example, Judge Stratton, when you asked, could you come up with some sort of act that would fit someone acting recklessly while purposely doing something? can't think of it in this context. The examples he gave were accidental touchings, which would address a strict liability argument, which I am not making the strict liability argument to this court. I think it's plain in the statute that purpose is included in the definition of the crime. The indictment, when it states sexual contact, contains that mens rea and gave him notice of that.
Given your stated position early on here, do we reverse or affirm the Court of Appeals?
I would believe that you would reverse it in terms of the holding of the case, but affirm the judgment here, because I don't believe that this is a case of structural error. There was no challenge at the trial level to any defect in the indictment, because there is no defect in the indictment. There was no challenge to the instructions given. And although Mr. Martin has brought this up in his reply brief and claims that the grand jury did not follow the law, he has no transcript, he has nothing there, I would posit that the grand jury is charged with knowing the statutory law and that they did consider the purpose of sexual gratification in determining that sexual contact occurred in this case. So there's no problem with a structural error analysis in this case. Grand jury found sexual contact. It found the criminal purpose, or the criminal intent, that he acted purposely in doing that. And given the factual scenario in this case, where the defendant committed the gross sexual imposition on the older of the two victims, went to his computer, viewed pornography, engaged in what the victim described as touching himself, or masturbation, she didn't use those words in the stand, but that's what she described, then came back to her, went back to the computer, went back to her younger sister, and engaged in the gross sexual imposition. Now, the fact, he purposely committed the touching in this case, and no reasonable person could find that. So if there's any error here, it may have been in the instructions, but that would be a plain error analysis, and there's no plain error here. There was no objection to the indictment, nor was there an objection to the instruction.
You've done this in your brief, Mr. Regas, but distinguish this case from Cologne for us, if you would.
Cologne found that the statute itself did not contain an element of mens rea. There was nothing there. Here, the statutes, taken in combination, obviously, with the definition, contain the definition of purpose. There's no need to apply or to insert something that is already there. Again, that would lead to a jury being told you have to find that he recklessly, purposely did something. That mens rea is at the end of the definition does not change.
You disagree that this crime could be committed with a reckless touching, or you say it doesn't matter what the mens rea was for the, or the motivation for the, I don't want to say motivation, but how the touching occurred. If the finding is for the purpose of sexual gratification, it presumes that the touching was also intentional.
Yes, because it was done purposely. It was done for that purpose. There's no reckless element that can be applied in that definition. The fact that for the purpose of sexual gratification occurs at the end of the definition doesn't change the meaning of that.
In other words, if the result is achieved, which is the sexual gratification intent, then it doesn't matter that there is no description on how that touching has to occur.
Exactly, because the touching is one element. That's the physical act, the actus reus. The mens rea would therefore be that act was done purposely.
The consequences of that act would be, is what you needed to, which is the sexual gratification.
Whether or not the sexual gratification was completed is an issue.
But the purpose, the intent, the result that was trying to be achieved, I guess.
Exactly. Purpose, intent, motivation, aim, goal. Mm-hmm. That's the definition of what intent is. So I think that it does come to, it doesn't matter. Because the touching is the physical act, the purpose that it's done for is the mens rea. There's no distinction between the two. There's not a separate element for touching. The gross sexual imposition is one physical act with a mental element. The mental element is the purpose of sexual gratification.
What you're saying is there's only one culpable mental state for this offense.
I'm saying for the touching, yes.
No, that's not my question.
For the physical act, Your Honor, yes.
For the offense of touching the erogenous zone of another under the age of 13 for the purpose of sexual gratification, how many culpable mental states do you find in that statute?
One, purposely.
Only one?
Only one.
Not two?
Not two. And I would say that throughout the gross sexual imposition statute, the other subsections, the touching itself needs to be done purposely for the mens rea, whereas the other subsections, the conditions under which the touching occurs, here the age, there's no knowledge or any other specific mental intent. That's a strict liability as to the age of the victim in this subsection.
Does your research show any case where any courts have found two separate culpable mental states for this offense?
No. For this offense, it's either been strict liability or purposely. Three districts have found strict liability. The rest have found that the state needs to prove the mens rea of purpose.
You believe it's not a strict liability statute and it's purpose?
That's our position, and that's how we read the law.
Mr. Regas, before Colon, the definition of the statute itself, the definition of the crime, rather, would normally just be cited as the statute was written. For example, as you just said, with the word purpose in it, written the way it was. Are prosecutors now taking a look at every single offense and adding in mental states to your knowledge? And that's a question I have, because I think we have somewhat complicated the indictment process through our opinion in Colon.
I can speak for our office, and after Colon came out, we did a thorough review of every statute, revised each statute and our indictment language to make sure that there was a mens rea, and where we found case law that said it was reckless, we made sure that was the default. We made sure to put that in.
But then the problem that Justice O'Donnell was touching on, where you have a definition that has separate acts to make up an offense, and would you say that there are prosecutors' offices that are not looking at every specific act and putting a mens rea to every specific act, even though the statute doesn't say that? I mean, I think that's what we heard counsel saying in opposition to your position.
Well, I think there's two classes of crimes that you need to look at. You need to divide these as to the predicate offense classes, which robbery was with theft. And then you need to look at other offenses, as the one in Clay, where there were actually two separate mental states that were found. There was, and the way I interpret it after Colon is that each element that is a separate act would require a separate mens rea or statement thereof if there is a separate one. In Clay, we saw that having a weapon under disability, having the weapon is knowingly, which is stated in the statute, but that each subsection had its own specific condition. So for under indictment, there was none, but this court found that it was recklessly, that it required one, that it was not strict liability. So if you go back to the GSI statute, what we have is the act of touching done purposely, and then I believe five subsections, which each then for those elements have a stated mens rea of purpose knowingly, or in this case, it's strict, definitely a statement of strict liability as to the age of the victim. So I don't think that, I really don't think that Cologne has changed the law. I think we go back, Cologne's not applicable to this case because the statute contains a definition. The definition includes the mens rea in this case. So I don't think Cologne is applicable at all in this argument, so that there is no defective indictment. There should not be a reversal on that basis or any basis of structural error in this case.
I'm curious whether your review of your records and then going forward, whether the addition of a mens rea in element in indictments has been an undue burden on your office, the prosecutor's office.
It felt that way for a while, Chief Justice. It really did in our unit.
How does it feel now?
It took a while, but I think that we've done a thorough review, and I can inform this court that any time that fraud is alleged, we rely on the definition of fraud for the mens rea in our indictments, and securing writings by deception, for example, has a situation where the mens rea is contained within the definition of fraud. We are not stating that particularly. We're relying on Buhner saying if you state the law, you give notice, and and the mens rea is stated in the definition. Although, that's our position.
Although it may turn out that we're going to have to pass on all of those specific offenses to determine if, in fact, the mens rea needs to be mentioned separately or not.
Well, if this court finds that this is purposely and relies on the fact that the statutory definition is there, I would say that it need not do that. For example, in the securing writings by deception, it requires one of the elements is fraud. Fraud is specifically defined with the mens rea. Just as we don't require a separate statement in the predicate offense cases of the mens rea of the underlying offense, we rely on the statutory description or in the statute. So we don't say, for example, in the burglary case that they knowingly trespassed. We just say they trespassed. We are not putting knowingly into our indictments because it's contained within that element. Then the specific mens rea for the subsections of the burglary, the predicate offense, if it's a murder in an aggravated burglary, then it's stated, obviously, as purpose.
Mr. Regas, let me ask you, would you go so far as to say that if there's a finding under B of the person acted with purpose to gratify himself or herself, that there could not be a finding of reckless, that the contact was reckless?
I think that by requiring a finding of purpose, recklessly, by inserting recklessly in there, the only reason that a criminal defendant would want this court to find that is to confuse a jury. That's the only purpose for making that argument. There's no, I tried to understand how you could recklessly, purposely do something. Once you find purpose, how it's been defined as being done. You can't be reckless and then find purpose. It's more of an intent, and reckless has a lesser degree of specific intent, aim, goal, or purpose, I think, is the instruction and definition of purpose. So it logically makes no sense.
I assume that's your, seems like that might be your response to Mr. Martin's argument that we don't want to find people guilty of a crime because they, particularly in the instance of two children, obviously, but an adult who happens to brush by someone and unintentionally touches an erogenous zone, the finding of purpose, I guess, undoes, is sort of the safeguard to that. Is that your argument?
Exactly. That's why those examples given as to reckless behavior, they were all premised upon an accidental placement, an unintentional placement. So in that regard, that is that safeguard against that. And I think that the confusion, the split in the law in this case comes from a 10th District case that analogized rape and GSI and confused sexual contact, which I would say is a strict liability offense when it's under 13, to GSI under 13, which or sexual conduct and sexual contact, and equated those in one sentence. And I think you can see that the other districts cited back to that 10th District case, State versus Astley, which is and I think one of the cases I pointed out, the State versus Mundy in my brief, points out where this any confusion came as to a strict liability offense versus the purpose. And as I pointed out, the majority of the districts do find it to be purpose. I ask that the judgment in this case be affirmed. However, this court find that the stated mens rea, that the mens rea stated that Cologne is not applicable, and there was no defect in this indictment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Regas. Mr. Martin, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you for your indulgence, Your Honor. May it please the Court. To go back to Mr. Chief Justice's question, which is, of course, a question that came up during my first argument, too. Purpose of sexual gratification will not solve all the problems here. Purpose of sexual gratification can include slow dancing. It can include hugging. It can include placing your hand on somebody's knee. And it's not always just an accident that child or adult.
But in your example where they're holding hands for the purpose of gratification and they accidentally touch another zone, they haven't touched the other zone for the purpose of sexual gratification, and so therefore you don't have a case.
Your Honor, they have...
In fact, you would want a purpose charge because it's harder to prove that.
And
in your example, if you said, well, you just recklessly touched it, you could be guilty. So you would want the purpose to attach also to the quote, accidental touching.
Well, and that moves to another thing. Normally, I would want that purpose charge, all right? The problem is the reason I can't go along with the state on the purpose charge is twofold. One, I would have to have this court then overrule Wamsley. I would have to have this court overrule Clay. And, quite frankly, I'm afraid that if I buy into their purpose argument, then it appears as if I'm also buying into their bootstrapping argument that purpose in one preposition at the end of a statutory provision can somehow be bootstrapped to the...
But in this case, there's only one act. Those other cases, you had two different predicate acts. There's one act you touch. The reason you touch is what gives you the criminal conviction. But there's only one thing that you do. You touch. And if you touch for the purpose, you're guilty. And if you touch accidentally or even recklessly, but not for the purpose, you're not guilty.
Your Honor, two things. One, in the burglary context, there is but one act as well. It is the entering for the purpose. And yet this court has had a bifurcated mens rea in Wamsley. In the weapon under disability, there is but one act. And yet there's a bifurcated mens rea. But in this particular situation, Your Honor, I can be having contact with a person for purpose of sexual gratification. And
but not contact with that particular zone that leads to the criminal conviction.
And the issue then...
Contact with other parts of the body don't count. You have to touch that zone for the purpose.
Your Honor... Let him answer first. If he has...
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I was saying you answer the question before another question comes to you.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, I would suggest to the court that that reading of the statute does not provide sufficient protection to the victims, that gross sexual imposition should be committed when a person is engaging in a certain amount of physical touching around and close to erogenous zones for purpose of sexual gratification, that he should not or she should not be able to turn around and say to a jury, my hand was 1 millimeter away from the erogenous zone, and yes, I was doing that for sexual gratification, and when my hand then moved on, that was not gross sexual imposition because that last millimeter wasn't purposeful. And I would suggest to the court that that was not the intention of the General Assembly, or the General Assembly would have put purposely into the first portion of that statutory definition as well. And in fact, putting it in the first portion of the statutory definition would have made more sense with respect to that. And I understand Your Honor's point, and obviously it's this weird situation where the state has got a more defense-friendly view of purposely, but they've done that in order to try to get this bootstrapping effect, which I would suggest to the court, if you do that, you go down a very slippery slope, because now you're going to raise purposely in the burglary context, in these other contexts as well, and it's going to make a lot of my clients' lives easier in the future in non-GSI cases. Now, Your Honor,
yes,
I'm sorry.
Mr. Martin, the hierarchy of mens rea, the statute that talks about that, 2901.22 in
yes.
E, Section E, when recklessness suffices to establish an element of an offense, then knowledge or purpose is also sufficient culpability for such element.
Yes.
So doesn't that dissolve your argument here, even if you were arguing that recklessness is the first part of the statute? The fact that we are talking about purpose subsumes recklessness into it, does it not?
Purpose will certainly cover reckless, but the state, if this court agrees with the state's argument that it is in fact purposeful, then in fact I would submit to the court that the structural error in this case is all the more egregious because of the fact that the state has said there's an even higher mental state. That's the thing. The state's arguing purpose doesn't cause them to win. It actually makes it worse for them. And the reason I'm not agreeing with it is because I don't want this court to abandon cases like Wamsley and Clay with respect to the no bootstrapping rule as to taking that mens rea from the back end and putting it on the front end of a statute, because that is part and parcel of this. And I might add, with respect to bootstrapping.
Very quickly.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Add very quickly.
Thank you very much.
Sum
this
up.
Is not in the authority I've cited. But interestingly, in the Model Penal Code, there is a provision that states, in response to Your Honor's question, there is a provision that states if there's a mens rea in one portion of the statute, it applies throughout the entire statute. Our General Assembly, in enacting the Ohio Revised Code as a model penal code jurisdiction, did not include that provision in the Ohio Revised Code. That should be considered an intentional omission. I reiterate my prayer. I thank you, Your Honor, for your time and for your indulgence in
thank
my
you,
going
Mr.
over.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.